and welcome to this edition of The Assault on Public Education. I'm Cheryl. If you've listened to previous shows, you know that there's a corporate and government-driven agenda to privatize public education using the trumped-up need for, quote, reform. And you also know that this is being financed by three key foundations: the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, and the Walton Foundation. Under former President George W. Bush's education reform program called No Child Left Behind, standardized testing was used to take over schools. If a certain number of students in any given school were not able to meet the testing requirements in math and English over a series of years, then the state could come in and could turn them over to charter schools, which is essentially privatizing them. Since poverty, English language needs, and unmet special education needs are key factors that affect test scores, under No Child Left Behind, these, quote, reformers had some success in privatizing schools in urban settings, but were not so successful in suburban and more affluent communities. Then Obama and his education secretary, Arne Duncan, brought in their reform program called Race to the Top. For school districts to get the funding attached to Race to the Top, they have to adopt the Common Core state standards and the testing that goes along with it. The test in Connecticut is called the SBAC. Many would argue that the Common Core state standards are developmentally inappropriate for many students and that it is being implemented very quickly without much piloting or research gathering on its impact or effectiveness. The SBAC test is taken on a computer and is an adaptive test, which means that if a student is able to answer the questions correctly, then they give him or her harder questions. So each student could potentially be taking a different test. So it's not really standardized, although they don't ever mention that. Teachers and school districts don't get to see the test that the students took, so they can't adapt instruction to the students' needs. And when enough students in a school don't meet the testing goals, then the state again can come in and privatize them by turning them over to charter schools. And to participate in and receive the federal funding under Race to the Top, it also requires that teacher evaluations be partially connected to student test scores. With this system, you can bet that you'll see a lot more teaching to the tests. And who could blame them? The system will force teachers to do this. To listen to the previous six shows, where all of this is discussed in detail, they're archived at radioforall.net, and that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, search for The Assault on Public Education, and the show should pop up. Governor Dan Malloy is very much an advocate of this privatization scheme. On the show with me today to discuss these issues as they relate to Connecticut is Jonathan Pelto, who's running for governor as a write-in candidate. Jonathan is a former state legislator and currently runs a blog called Wait, What? Jonathan Pelto, welcome to the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite and a chance to come back and update you on some of the things that have been going on over the last few months.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about the election and where you're at with it?
Well, now that the election is within sight, some of the listeners know that I was a petitioning candidate for governor this year, did not collect enough petitions to get on the ballot, which turned out to be a much more challenging process than I had fully appreciated, despite the fact that I've been involved in politics and government here in Connecticut for many years, was a state legislator for 10 years, and have been on the outskirts of some of the political activities over the last 40 years, sometimes working for campaigns. Over the last 4 years as a advocacy journalist, investigative blogger with my own blog called Wait What, when I was actually running for office, really learned about the impediments to getting on the ballot. And so at this point, we did not qualify, so my name will not be on the ballot, although there is a section in which supporters can write in my name, and so I have officially registered as a write-in candidate. The process was one that I think it really reflects both how the system is able to maintain itself and how, while we call ourselves a democracy, the impediments that exist to real democratic participation. And so I came away from this process both surprised, disappointed personally that I didn't get on, but equally upset and angry about the need to reform the way in which our democracy works to ensure that more people are heard from and that, most importantly, that voters have more choices. Connecticut appears to be particularly difficult. It's not so much that the number you need is 7,500. It's 1% of the people who voted in the last election, or 7,500 good signatures, that is, signatures from Connecticut voters. The number itself is not so significant, although the barriers to getting those are. And I'll just take a moment to highlight a couple of them. But in a discussion that I had with Ralph Nader, who was cautioned me about something that turned out to be, he was absolutely correct, and that is that you go out and you collect signatures from Connecticut citizens. You need to get signatures from those that are registered to vote. And there are people who think that they're registered to vote and aren't. But there's a much more serious problem, and that is the way in which the petition process works is you have to make sure that people sign on the page for their town and their town only. So with 169 towns, you end up with 169 pages every time you go out trying to collect petitions, or you end up with a lot of pages because the person says, I'm from South Windsor, you then need to start a new petition for South Windsor. All of those pages then get distributed to the 169 towns, and they can, the town clerk can review those, or they can give them to the local registrar of voters. So when you do the math, there are up to 500 people who have the authority or the opportunity to review signatures. And while the law is very clear that you are supposed to interpret the signature process with the voter's intent in mind, what became clear was that oftentimes registrar voters, and especially town clerks, viewed it as a very different process. And that was, their goal was to eliminate names, and we found hundreds and hundreds of examples where it was clear that it was a voter. They had signed it, their signature was there, their name was there, their address was there. When we went and looked at the voter list, they were a voter, but they had been rejected. And when we found that out, as the process was during the counting process, two things were really disturbing about it. First off, you don't know that those names have been rejected until the petitions have gone from the local level to the state level. And even when talking with the lawyers at the state level and the Secretary of State's office, and they would say, yes, that person should not have been rejected. The answer, the question then was, okay, so what do we do about it? And the answer was, well, there's really nothing you can do about it, even though we all knew that the law had been violated, including the Secretary of State's own lawyers. They said what you'd have to do is you'd have to take this petition back to the town. You'd have to convince the town clerk or the registrar of voters to change their mind, and then you'd have to get the petition back in time. But because the deadline has already gone by, and because you can't touch the petition once it's been certified, there's no way to do that. It's a catch-22. So there were lawyers standing there with me, and we were going through the petitions, and we were identifying dozens of people whose names were then not counted. And the answer was, the only way to do it is after the whole process is through, the candidate then sues the Secretary of the State at the state level. That then goes to court, and the Secretary of State then forces the town clerks to come up and testify why they had rejected that name. So the cost and the length of the process would prevent any petitioning candidate from making it through unless they had so many extra names. So even though the law says you only need 7,500, the other petitioning candidate, Joe Visconti, he collected 10,600. We don't know how many of them ended up being rejected, but once you get to 7,500, they stop the process and they put you on the ballot. And so one of the things we'll do in the meantime is to go back and look at where were they rejected. In some towns, the rejection rate was 5%. In other towns, the rejection rate was 45%. And the examples where people were rejected that shouldn't have been, one was the person lived, let's say it was Southwood Drive, and they left off the street number. And the town clerk had rejected it because there was no street number. So I went and looked, and there were only four houses on Southwood Drive, and that person's name was right there. And the law doesn't say that it has to have the right street number and street. The law only says that the town clerk or registrar must determine that the person is a voter from that town. In another case, a woman who maybe she had gotten married, I don't know why, but she wrote down, let's say, Susan Williams Jones, and it had Susan Williams Jones. She wrote it down. That was her signature. She had the correct street address. She had the correct birth date. And the registrar rejected it, circled the name Susan Williams, and said, she's registered as Susan Williams, not Susan Williams Jones. Therefore, you're rejected. These example after example.
Do you think if you could have reinstated all of the signatures that they threw out that were really legitimate, would you have made the 7,500 required?
Well, I think that we still fell short. What happened was that we started very late. We started almost at the end of June. And so we only had 9 weeks and we needed to do a better job and we just didn't do it. I think we would have been close. And I had decided that we would go the court route if we needed to, if it was clear that that would get us onto the ballot, but it wasn't clear to me that it was. Joe Visconti, who I got to know a little bit during the campaign, he will be on the ballot. He and I have come from very different philosophical backgrounds, but he is very strong supporter of gun rights and opposes any restrictions on guns. He set up a booth, a table, outside of Hoffman's gun shop and collected signatures every day for 8 weeks. And it was a brilliant move on his part. He had a ready-made constituency. In my case, I was talking about a lot of different issues, but I was particularly talking about education. The schools were already out for the summer, and so we didn't have a place that we could go and collect easily teachers and parents. And so in retrospect, if we had started a little earlier, I think we would have been more successful. But the eye-opener was that of the many things that we need to change in this state and in this country, and it's actually something that Nader has talked about a lot, and both in his own presidential runs and just as an advocate for democracy, is that this is not healthy for a democracy when people cannot get on the ballot. And what was so interesting to me was the pushback, particularly from the establishment in both the Democrat and Republican parties. I mean, the calls to get out of the race. It happened both to Joe Visconti from the Republican side and to me on the more Democratic side. In my case, you know, somebody like Rosa DeLauro putting out a press release saying that I should get out of the race. Rosa DeLauro and I having worked together for over 30 years and I would have thought would have been a strong supporter of the notion that people's views should be heard. And even somebody like Rosa, Chris Dodd, also said the same thing, pretty much said the same thing, was an eye-opener to the fact that the establishment is so afraid of having other choices, that they claim to be for democracy, they claim to want to push the rights of easier voter registration, easier voting, that we want more people to participate. And then as soon as there's any sign of that happening, it's like, this is not good. We want you to get out of the race. In my case, there were even people who were writing and saying, don't sign his petition because it will be bad for the Democratic candidate. So it was a lesson to me and I think to all of us that if we want more democracy, we're going to have to force the system to change the laws. The other one that was really interesting in the process was the insult that I heard most often from the establishment is that you will, quote unquote, you will be a Ralph Nader. And I had the opportunity to talk with Nader a couple of times about it. He was kind enough to let us come and collect signatures. He was on a speaking tour and he spoke at three different places in Connecticut, four different places, and he allowed us to come and collect signatures. And he had obviously there's a reason he has such a profound impact on the United States, far more than simply just running as the third party candidate. There's a reason that he was identified as one of the 100 greatest Americans in history is because of his work on behalf of consumer rights going back now 50 years.
I was going to say it would be a proud moment to be called Ralph Nader or like Ralph Nader.
So. That's right. And I had told Nader that I don't know when it was, but I think it was third or fourth grade. We had to write an essay on who we wanted to be, or who we admired most, or who we wanted to be when we grew up. And I said I wanted to be Ralph Nader, or like Ralph Nader. And so it was just an incredible honor. And I'm glad I ran, if for no other reason than getting to meet him and to be called, you're just another Ralph Nader, meaning somehow that you are throwing the system. And so trying to understand what people were referring to. And of course, they thought that what they were referring to was in the Bush-Gore campaign in Florida, where they said that Ralph Nader had taken away enough votes that had he not been in the race, Gore would have won Florida, and therefore he would have become president, and we wouldn't have had all of the results from George W. Bush. We can argue whether or not there would have been that many changes or not, but that was the insult, was that you're Ralph Nader. So I actually went in and did some investigation and research about it, and it turned out that there were 10 third-party candidates on the ballot in Florida, in addition to Gore and Bush. And all 10 of those candidates individually got more votes than the margin between Gore and Bush. And so while Ralph Nader gets, quote-unquote, the blame because he got 46,000 votes, Al Gore, under the illegal count, the Supreme Court's abbreviated illegal recount, Bush won by 547 votes. So it turns out that Ralph Nader was not the reason that Al Gore lost, although you could say any of the 10 third-party candidates impacted the outcome. But what was the real eye-opener was that 280,000 Democrats in Florida voted for Bush instead of Gore. Ralph Nader got 47,000 votes. So the reason that Al Gore lost was because Democrats left Al Gore and voted for Bush. And we can have a good debate about, you know, whether Al Gore was the best candidate or not the best candidate or what would have happened. But what was such an interesting was that Democratic leaders, including a number of union leaders, what they came up with to say why I shouldn't be running, the insult that they hurled at me, that was sort of the best shot that they had, is, you know, hit me with your best argument. And the best argument is you're going to be Ralph Nader. And it turned out that they were completely wrong on the impact that Ralph Nader had. And I didn't mind being called Ralph Nader anyway, but once I understood that, in fact, Ralph Nader wasn't the spoiler in Florida. Al Gore was the spoiler in the sense that he wasn't able to keep the Democrats voting Democratic. And that happens all over the country because as the Democratic Party leaves its base, which it is doing here in Connecticut and other places around the country where you really now can't in many cases tell the difference between a Democrat and a Republican, they become members of the incumbency party. And you have lots of constituencies that are traditionally Democratic in this state, for example, teachers and state employees, middle-class homeowners that are feeling overly burdened because the state refuses to deal with high property taxes. So they're leaving the Democratic Party. And what does the Democratic Party say? That instead of recognizing that they're on the wrong side of those issues and that if they actually represented those constituencies, they would earn those votes back. Instead, what they want to do is they want to keep any challengers from rising up. And so I'm very glad that I ran. I wish I was on the ballot. I wanted to be on the ballot so that I could participate in the debates and also have even more of an impact on the vote. But I do feel like I got some important issues addressed, that the education issue that I had been talking about is really now front and center, even though none of the candidates, in my mind, are addressing it correctly. At least they're talking about it.
So is there any difference between Malloy and Foley on education and also you or Visconti? Because you're running as a write-in candidate and Visconti's on the ballot. What are the choices the voters are looking at?
Yeah, well, the problem is that Malloy is very late in the process, is now saying or implying that he would try to do some things differently. But he's sending very mixed messages. He'll say one thing one day, and then the next day he'll sort of fall back on his approach. The bottom line is that Daniel Malloy is the only Democratic governor in the United States who proposed doing away with teacher tenure and repealing collective bargaining for teachers working in the poorest school districts. No other Democrat has proposed such a bad policy. The Democratic legislature stripped out those two provisions and then went on to pass the rest of Malloy's corporate education reform industry initiative. Malloy to this day has never recanted on that position. And so there are a lot of teachers and parents and public school advocates that rightfully say, how can you vote for a governor who proposed such bad things and became such a leader of the corporate education reform industry movement? Now he's saying that he will modify some of those positions, but he never modified them during this last legislative session. He hasn't proposed any real changes, and most people recognize that what he said about education is a last-ditch effort just to get teachers to hold their nose or close their eyes and vote for Malloy. On the other hand, Foley, who had the opportunity to really articulate a different position, except for on the Common Core, where Foley apparently is more against the Common Core than Malloy is certainly for the Common Core. Just in the last week or so, Foley has proposed his education policies, and they look very much like Malloy's. And it's not surprising because the corporate education reform movement, this massive effort across the country to undermine public education, go to the Common Core, go to massive amounts of standardized testing, take away local control, shift money from public schools to charter schools. It was proposed under Bush the second and dramatically expanded under Obama. So we have a situation at the national level where the Democrats and Republicans are trying to outdo each other as to who's more for corporate public education than the other. Here in Connecticut, Malloy and Foley seem to be almost involved in that same battle, that neither of them is clearly articulating what's best for public education, what's best for students and parents and teachers and public advocates.
Yeah. I thought in our state, because we have this campaign finance law, that the candidates could be more independent thinking and not have to cave into the corporate demands because they're donating to their campaigns. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Right. And in fact, corporate education reform industry continues to be a huge source of money for both political parties. They funnel that money into the parties in a number of ways. But in Connecticut, we went from having what was arguably the best campaign finance reform law in the country that passed in 2005 after John Rowland, former Governor Rowland, went to prison. It was a campaign finance reform based on the premise that you have a choice. You can participate in the public financing system, in which case the public dollars will be given to you to run your campaign. And if you do that, then you cannot accept any other money from special interests, from corporations, from companies that do business with the state, from unions, from anybody. Then 2 years ago, after Governor Malloy had been elected, and he was the first one to use the public financing system, he proposed and the Democrats passed a series of changes that created massive loopholes in Connecticut's campaign finance law, basically undid the most important tenets of the law. So this year, both Malloy and Foley got a check for $6.2 million in public funds, taxpayer funds, to pay for their campaigns. And so many of the television ads that you see are being paid for by public dollars, and the television ads are nothing but attack ads on each other. But as a result of these massive loopholes that Malloy proposed and the Democrats supported, not only is Malloy and Foley using their $6 million each in public funds, but they each are going to spend somewhere between $10 and $15 million in special interest donations that would have been disallowed under the Connecticut's campaign finance reform, but because of the changes, they are now allowed to sneak that money in sneaky ways. But many of the ads, for example, are being paid for by entities that are basically controlled by the candidates. And in fact, if you look closely, you'll see that it says on the ad, paid for by the Democratic State Central Committee, which is separate of the Malloy campaign. And then in small letters, it will say approved by Dan Malloy. So they know exactly what they're doing, and they're funneling corporate money, special interest money, even money from people who do business with the state, and they're funneling it into the political campaigns, in addition to collecting and using the public funds. I did a research project just last week and found that the education reform people had already donated more than $250,000 to Malloy's campaign. So in the sense that, you know, why would you be taking these positions? Some of the positions have been so anti-teacher, anti-student, anti-parent that you'd say a reasonable person would never take those positions unless either they had no understanding of how public education worked, or they decided it was in their political interest to take a position that actually hurt the very people you were sworn to serve. And in this case, we have apparently both Malloy and to some degree, a lesser degree, I think a little bit, Foley, saying that I'm going to take positions that are against the very people I want their votes. But because the only reasonable and logical conclusion is that because I can get so much money in campaign funds, that it's worth it to me to take a position that is against the people that I'm trying to get to vote for me. In Malloy's case, not only has he taken $250,000, but one organization alone, this group called ConCan, which is the lead group pushing charter schools, they were the ones who put the lobbying campaign together in support of Malloy's bill. Malloy's corporate education reform bill of 2012 was the most expensive lobbying campaign in Connecticut history. This group, and funded by groups from outside of Connecticut with extra money, spent over $6 million to get Malloy's bill through. No other issue has ever brought in that much money to try to convince legislators to vote. That group, ConCan, just its board members alone and their immediate families have given Malloy over $100,000. And Malloy has traveled around the country collecting money from the corporate education reform movement. In earlier episodes, we talked about where did the corporate education reform movement come from. It's really funded by three major foundations, the Gates Foundation, the Walton Foundation, which is the Walmart family, and the Broad Foundation. Eli Broad is a billionaire from Los Angeles, and if you go and you look at where Malloy is collecting his money, you'll see an $8,000 check from Eli Broad, one of the largest contributions he made. But it pales by some of the others. There's a family down in Greenwich, the Sackler family. They own Purdue Pharma. That family alone, husband and wife, have given over $50,000 to Malloy. There's another billionaire, Steve Mandel, also from Greenwich. He's given over $40,000 to the Malloy campaign. So as you go through Malloy's fundraising operation, you can see, you can trace that campaign money that's pouring in from a number of different corporate interests, but far clearer is the money that's coming from the corporate education industry.
Yeah, and are the state legislators also getting these corporate donations in addition to the public funds?
Most are not. Most are taking the public funds and using the public funds and adhering to, or at least primarily utilizing those funds. Because the system, the way the system is set up, it's very difficult for an individual state legislator to set up multiple committees, but it's very easy for the governor to set up multiple committees. So it's really that old adage that a fish rots from the head. When looking at the campaign finance system in Connecticut, which we've already had a governor go to prison because of misusing or accepting or trying to collect campaign funds and personal funds, we went from having a system where a governor went to prison to having a system that was very good, to now going back to a system that the people's interests, it's almost the worst of all.
Yeah, it's worse than having no campaign finance law at all, because they're still getting the $6 million plus in public funds and the corporate donations, totally corrupting the system.
That's right. I mean, what basically what the governor and the legislature did is when you add it all up, and we're talking well over $200 million, I mean, the number of things that we could be taking care of in this state with the money that's being used to give to candidates, both Democrat and Republican, there's no, the system doesn't particularly help Democrats. It helps any candidate, incumbents more than anybody else, because they already have a lot of name recognition. Then both sides are given money to try to equal the playing field. But the fact is that with that money, the original understanding was that was going to get the special interest money out of the system. And in fact, now they get our money and they take the special interest money. And so, as we just said, if anything, it's actually worse than it was before.
So when you were on the show a couple of months ago, we talked about the charter school, the Jamokey Academy. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about charter schools in general for listeners who may not know about them. And also give us an update on the Jamokey Academy.
Yeah, so the issue about the corporate education reform industry and what's happening across the country is that they are primary proponents of the Common Core and the Common Core testing scheme. And reasonable people can have a reasonable discussion about the Common Core. The Common Core is really a set of national standards that seek to increase the performance of students. And nothing wrong with standards. Some of the standards are better than Connecticut had. Some of them are not as good. We could have developed and should have developed standards on our own, just like we always had in conjunction with teachers and local communities. But these Common Core standards were from the top down, and they were created really as a way to promote then having to have these new testing to determine whether the students were following the Common Core standards. And the new testing was this massive Common Core test in Connecticut. It's called the SBAC test. So not only would you be spending more time testing, you'd have to buy all new computers, you'd have to buy all new software. You'd have to pay for all of the new tests. The tests would be on an annual basis. In addition, you'd then have to have software to prepare the students to take the test. You then have to have the consultants come in to teach the teachers how to teach to the test. And it was, I have to say, a brilliant way to divert hundreds of millions of dollars across the country into corporate coffers using public funds. And it's the same thing that historically, back when President Eisenhower warned the country in his last speech before giving the White House over to John F. Kennedy, he warned us of the military-industrial complex and how the military-industrial complex was rigging the system to take public funds and dump them into the defense industry, and we ended up with $50 toilet seats or $500 hammers. Well, the same thing is happening in education, and it's happening by major corporations that are pushing the Common Core and the Common Core testing. So that was one of the key provisions of what's happening. The second one is the privatization of public education. That is, creating schools that don't report to a board of education. They are owned by a private company. They are run by a private company. The companies tend to, but not always, are quote-unquote nonprofit. But as we know, there are lots of nonprofits that can pay their CEOs, and they look like private companies. They are private companies. They just have special tax rights that regular companies don't have, but it doesn't mean that they're not ripping off people. In Connecticut, the charter schools that have developed are all quote-unquote nonprofit, but in a number of other states, and I would assume there will be an effort here in Connecticut before too long, you actually have for-profit charter schools that are trying to come in. But from what I've seen across the country, there's been no real difference in the quality of the charter schools when they're nonprofit or for-profit. I suppose the for-profit ones are actually a little worse, but the nonprofit ones have not done very well. We're just getting to understand the impact here in Connecticut. We really didn't have very many charter schools until Malloy became governor. But in Chicago now, almost 50% of the students are going to schools that are privately run. In Philadelphia, almost 50%. In New Orleans is the first school system that is 100% privatized. That is, there is no public school system in New Orleans. You go to charter schools, and so it's all public funds going to these private companies. The private companies then have to meet some, but not all, of the regulations. And for most part, as we're beginning to find, that many of these charter schools are really unaccountable for are not held accountable for their actions or for how they spent their money. Since the Malloy administration took office, one of their pet projects was to build up a company that was called the Jamoke Academy. It was a charter school, or it is a charter school. They had one school in Hartford, and they created a holding company. I mean, it's just as corporate as you can get in the way that they do these things. They created a holding company called Fuse, so it became Jamoke Fuse. They were given a no-bid contract to run a school in Hartford, the Milner School. They were then given a no-bid contract to run a school in Bridgeport, the Dunbar School. They were then approved for running a new charter school in New Haven. Meanwhile, they had already collected $54 million in public funds to run their existing charter school. Their existing charter school will not take Spanish-speaking students. Their existing charter school will not take special education students. They will only take the students that they want. Anybody else is either not accepted or pushed out. So what they are is a private school, but instead of having to come up with the money themselves or charging students or parents to send their kids to a private school, these corporations have figured out a way to run private schools but are paid for with public dollars. But they don't serve the public. They only serve a small subsegment.
Do they get more money than the public schools?
In some cases, they do, because particularly in places where schools are not that, the state funding is not that sufficient, they actually end up getting more state funding. Since Malloy took office, he has increased funding for charter schools by 79%. He's increased funding for public schools by 7%. So there has been a massive shift in investment of dollars, of hundreds of millions of dollars, to these private entities. And it turned out that Jamoke and Fuse, basically, it was, the company has now collapsed. The head of the company had said that he had a PhD. Turned out that that wasn't true. He had been convicted and served time in prison for embezzlement when he was in San Francisco, where he had stolen $200,000 in public funds and had served 5 years in jail, and that they were using the money for things other than educational services. They were buying houses. They were renovating houses. There have been a number of stories. The Hartford Courant has done just a phenomenal job of a series of investigative stories written by a team led by John Lender, the Courant's investigative reporter. And since all of that has come out, the FBI has swooped in. They've taken all of the documents, the computers. They are asking for all of the emails and documents from state officials and city officials and from what was the Jamoke Fuse Company. And I think that before this is over, there will be indictments, that people will go to prison, because Jamoke Fuse has become a prime example of what happens when you give private companies money. And it shouldn't come as any surprise. We may have even talked about it, in this guy who, the disgraced former CEO of Jamoke, when he was confronted at a legislative hearing, or asked a question, not confronted, about why they had so few special education students. In most school districts around the state, about somewhere between 12% and 14% of the students have some kind of fairly significant special education needs. Jamoke had less than 3%. Michael Sharp, the person formerly known as Dr. Michael Sharp, he said that they had a special program that went in at kindergarten and they cured the students of their special education needs. And legislators didn't respond by saying that's absurd. I mean, these are special education needs that are real and legitimate, whether they're a form of autism or mental retardation, developmental disabilities. Many of them don't even show up until after the kindergarten years. And there he was, touting how good his test scores were when they had never once taken a bilingual student and they refused to even admit that special education services were needed because they said that they could cure those students, when in fact, when we looked at the data, it was clear that they just dropped the students from the schools. So this company has basically stolen millions and millions of dollars from the public. Ironically, the charter school is still open. The Malloy administration put the holding company on probation, the Fuse part of the Jamoke Fuse, but they allowed the Jamoke part to continue. So taxpayers are continuing to fund the charter school known as Jamoke Academy. The other ones have all fallen by the wayside, but not before this company took millions of dollars, additional money from the state and from the federal government, and even from foundations. So I think we're likely to see, if Malloy gets reelected and continues this strong support for charter schools, we're likely to see other charter schools running into financial and legal troubles because they are not held accountable in the same way. They report directly to the State Board of Education, when it's not to say that problems don't exist in local schools, but as everyone knows, in the small towns and even the cities, when problems exist, they often come to light at school board meetings, or at least you have the local control, and you have local officials, you have or employees of the city who see their responsibility of, or should see their responsibility, and many do, of protecting the interests. When they only report to the State Board of Education, and the commissioner is a strong supporter of charter schools, and all of the members of the State Board of Education have been appointed by a governor who's a strong supporter, the evidence about Jamoke was clear long before the Hartford Courant started writing it. But once the Hartford Courant started writing it, then suddenly the administration wanted to do something about it, because they had been caught. And so they decided that they would throw Jamoke Fuse under the bus. They would demand investigations. They'd put the company on probation. They would do an audit, when they should have done all of those things long before the Hartford Courant had it on the front page. But sadly, now, in many cases, the only way to hold elected officials accountable is when they have to read about it in the newspaper, and then they suddenly find the pressure is on. They finally decide to do the right thing. So when you talk about the corporate education reform industry across the country and in Connecticut, many people really focus almost exclusively on the Common Core and the Common Core testing part, which is understandable because that's what's messing up education in every town in Connecticut. Joe Visconti is a strong opponent of the Common Core and the Common Core testing. And so when it comes to just this, those issues now, of the three candidates, Joe Visconti, Tom Foley, and Dan Malloy, only Visconti is against the use of the Common Core and the Common Core testing, and is not a big fan. He believes, apparently, has articulated a strong support for local control. But as you look across the country, almost as serious a threat to public education as the Common Core and the Common Core testing is this issue of the privatization. And once it gets a foothold, what they want to do is they want to get as many charter schools as possible. And then under the Malloy administration, we've seen something that in some ways is even worse, and that is they are hiring the charter schools to run the public schools. And in the two places where that happened, they both have now dropped the relationship with the charter school in Hartford and in Bridgeport. They also tried to do it and didn't get away with it in Waterbury. But you have a local school board in Waterbury and Hartford and every other town. And what the Malloy administration did was they said, we're going to take over individual schools and we're going to give them to private companies to run.
And just so that people understand, there's a connection between the Common Core and the Common Core tests and charter schools. Because if enough students in a given public school repeatedly don't reach the required scores on the tests, then the state can come in and turn them over to charter schools. So the tests are a key link in turning public schools into private schools.
Exactly. That's exactly. That it is all under one umbrella because it's actual federal law, and it started with Bush and then was expanded under Obama, is that if the schools do not do well, as defined by the tests, then the lowest performing schools not only can but must be taken over, or must be, the language that they call is, they must become turnaround schools. And there's a series of things that you can then do with a turnaround school. One option is to bring the community together and come up with a plan. But what we learned from all of the documentation from that came out during the Jamoke Fuse disaster is that the Malloy administration was basically saying, you really have two choices. You can either turn it into a charter school or you can hire a charter school to run your public school. Across the country, the way that then it works is that as you introduce the Common Core or the tougher tests, and again, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with trying to get our students to do better. But what we know is that the factors that lead to this achievement gap, the reason that is really based on poverty and language barriers and insufficient special education services. If you look at Connecticut's public education system, our lowest group of students performs at or above how the average students do in Louisiana. So, in fact, Connecticut should be held out as an example where we are succeeding in providing quality education. Now, there's a problem in that our wealthy areas end up with much more academic success because they don't have to deal with the factors associated with poverty and language barriers and insufficient special education services. So any normal person, any parent, any teacher, any public school advocate would say, okay, well then let's work on those problems of how do you deal with, I mean, schools can't change poverty on their own, but they can have programs that help students who come from poor families where the child is hungry or doesn't have the support at home that they need. They can certainly do better on dealing with bilingual education and dual language programs and helping students learn and succeed. And they can certainly provide better special education services. But what the corporate education reform movement is all about is let's not talk about poverty or language or special ed. Let's just look at the fact that we need to do better on tests. And those schools that don't do well, we need to take them over. New York, which is a year ahead of us, has introduced their Common Core test. And what they found was they went, let's say with bilingual students, they went from about 40% of the students, an appropriate level on the test, to 3% of the students. So basically what the test was designed to do was to ensure that 100% of the, virtually 100% of the bilingual students were told that they were failures and the schools they were going to were failures. Now, there are problems in those schools that need to be dealt with, but to start from kindergarten on telling a child that they're a failure and their school is a failure, and because of that, they're going to give the school to a private company to run, is dishonest. It's against everything that a democracy should be for. It, quite frankly, flies in the face of American public education and what American public education was supposed to mean. And yet they're getting away with it all over the country, and now they're trying to do more and more of it here in Connecticut.
Yeah, so the English language learners and the special ed kids are really needed by the corporate reformers because these are often the students who are going to bring the test scores down through no fault of their own and open up the schools for charter takeover.
And things like under the older system, the one that if any of us, any as listeners if have children or if they're younger, they'll remember the Connecticut Mastery Test, which is what we had. And the Connecticut Mastery Test had its problems, but one of the things that they would allow is that special education students would be exempted out of having to take the Connecticut Mastery Test. One is because that it was really unfair to the student, and because it artificially pulled the score down, and that is that if you had special education students taking the test, then the test scores obviously on average would be lower because these would be students who were not going to be able to take the test. Interestingly, and you can see then how sophisticated the corporate education reform movement is that every student, virtually every student, has to take the Common Core test. And the way they bill it is, well, of course we want everybody to take the test. But when you think about it, and you stop and you think about, well, what does that mean? We want everybody to take the test. We even want people that we know can't take the test, either physically, mentally, or just not capable, not ready, are not going to be able to succeed at this test. Why would we want them to take the test? Well, we want them to take the test because when you include those people, then the average scores are lower. And when the average scores are lower, it's easier to claim that our public education system is failing. And if our public education system is failing, then why not give it to private companies to run? And one of the things that, again, about the Common Core versus the Common Core testing is the Common Core is basically designed to be two grade levels above where American children are now. And we may, as a country, want to be able to say, you know, our goal is to get students to score, to learn at two grade levels. So if you're now in first grade, eventually we really want in first grade to be teaching what they're now teaching in third grade. Other people say that's developmentally inappropriate. I mean, now that we have standardized tests in kindergarten, you wonder what kind of society we're going to create when you get out of school and you go for your job and you say, well, what skills do you have? Well, the only skill I have is I learned how to take a standardized test. But to me, the real telling reason, proof that the Common Core and the Common Core test is a scam, is that if you wanted to get your first graders to the third grade level, you would develop standards and implement them over 10 years or 15 years. You'd say, as a society, we want our schools to be teaching at a much more advanced level. But to do it on the spot is guaranteed to ensure failure. And it's going to ensure failure for the foreseeable future. You simply can't get first graders to be taking tests at the third grade level without all the other changes that would need to go with that, including better funding, more support for teachers, better teacher education. I think parents already know that our children are learning things that we never saw. I mean, our schools are not failing. We have a huge achievement gap in this state because we have the largest gap between rich and poor of any state in the country. And because rich and poor score really are an indicator of resources, and resources are an indicator of how well you do in school, for the most part, of course we have the largest achievement gap. We have the largest achievement gap because we have two different societies within one. And if we want to deal with that and should deal with that, then we need to deal with that. But making everybody take the same test is not going to work. But what it will work is it will work for the companies that are trying to take over schools.
Let's go back to these Common Core tests for a minute. I know that they're computer adaptive, and we talked about that before, but I think it's worth mentioning again. So if a student's doing well on a test, the questions get harder. So the test isn't really standardized because everybody's getting different questions. And isn't it true that the school districts and the teachers never get to see the actual tests the students took?
That's right. Well, again, the Malloy administration was trying to push through the Common Core test as the actual test last year. There were so many problems that they said that it would be, you know, a field test. There would be flexibility last year. They pushed off the effective date, requiring everybody to take the test and using the test results to evaluate teachers until January of 2015, conveniently just after the election. So last year was sort of a dry run, and we know that there were huge problems with it. This year, unless the new governor works to postpone it, we're going to have the full thing, and people will really be shocked because it's exactly what you're saying. First off, the primary issue is it's computer-based, and so the children who have more computer skills automatically will do better than children who don't. And it's not simply computer skills like being able to use your Game Boy. It's computer skills with knowing keyboards, with knowing how to work with programs. You read something on the screen, you then answer the questions. If you know how to manipulate the software, you can go back and check the wording, which is a few pages back. But if you don't, you're answering questions having only read it once. So what we know is that students who know how to use computers will have an easier time going back and checking, and students who don't will just keep on plodding along. The second is that it is designed to find out where the child fails. It is not designed to find out whether the child has learned the curriculum. It is to find out what they don't know. The way that the nature of the program works is it's immediately designed for students to have harder questions to the point that they very early on don't know the answer. So you're basically forcing students to come to grips that they don't know something and then come back and tell them that they're failures because they don't know something even if they hadn't in fact been taught it. And one of the greatest scams of all is that we have the Common Core standards and we have the Common Core test, but we don't have any Common Core curriculum. We have bits and pieces of a Common Core curriculum. And towns are being told they have to buy all new textbooks that are Common Core compliant. They have to buy all new software that's Common Core compliant. But nobody actually has developed the comprehensive curriculums that are Common Core curriculums. So the children are being tested on things that they haven't even learned and then being told they're failures because they didn't know something that they had no opportunity to have known in the first place. And the teachers will, you know, one of the worst things, and I think it was one of the reasons that I had wanted to run and to raise this issue, was that hidden inside or a part of Malloy's education reform bill was that a new evaluation system for teachers that would include the results of these standardized tests. Nothing wrong with evaluating teachers. There's lots of good models out there on how to do that. Nothing wrong with demanding that our teachers learn more, do more, although I think the vast majority of teachers are extraordinarily successful already. I mean, all of us know that we've had some teachers that weren't as good as others, but for the most part, teachers in Connecticut are really outstanding and are performing at an extraordinary level, considering all of the challenges that students bring in. But the most unfair part of Malloy's bill, of the entire bill, is the fact that you would judge then the teacher's performance on these standardized test scores. Because if you come from a wealthier town where the scores are going to be higher, you'll then be deemed to be a better teacher. And if you are working in a poor district where you'd want the teachers, the best teachers to go, the standardized test scores will be lower because the results are driven by poverty and language barriers and special education needs that go unmet. The very teachers that you would want to be supporting will be getting lower evaluations and will then, if you get too low evaluations, you get removed, that we'll have the best teachers wanting to get out of the urban school districts.
Do you also see that happening within districts, too, where certain schools may have more English language learners or more poverty?
A good example of that is many people in Connecticut think of Greenwich as being just extraordinarily wealthy, and the major part of Greenwich is extraordinarily wealthy, but it also has a poor part of Greenwich. So teachers will want to teach in one set of schools and not in the other because their evaluations and their very careers will be affected by the school in which they teach in and whether it's in the poor part or the wealthier part of a town like Greenwich. In Greenwich, it's the wealthy part is so obnoxious as they actually wanted to create their own school district so they wouldn't even have to have any of the poor students come over to their schools for any kind of programs. So the fact is what we need is a governor and a legislature that is willing to admit the truth, which is we have a real problem with poverty and language barriers and special education services that go unmet, and we need to face those and we need to help those students. And when we do that, we will close our achievement gap. But the corporate education model that they've adopted instead is going to make things worse and is going to end up with public funds being wasted at levels that we have never imagined or seen before.
And it seems to me that one of the key ways or easiest ways to thwart this new system of corporate reform is for parents to simply opt their students out of the test. And maybe you could speak to that?
That's right. And in fact, the law is very clear, and that is parents have the right to opt their students out. The parental rights, both under federal law and state law. And instead of granting parents that right, the State Department of Education and school districts have really worked very hard to mislead and even lie to parents. What the academic evidence is that if even 6%, 5 or 6% of the students opted out, then the integrity of the entire data would collapse because they wouldn't have the range of students that are needed in order to pull off this stunt. And there are lots of states around the country in which significant numbers of parents are opting out. Here in Connecticut, because the governor, administration, and local districts are saying you can't do it, many parents have thought that they don't have that right. But they do, and they can check. There are lots of websites out there, one called Fair Test, one called Opt Out. But if they search on their right to opt out, they will find out ways in which they can and should opt their children out of these unfair and inappropriate tests.
Okay, great. So, Jonathan, you're a write-in candidate along with your Lieutenant Governor Ebony Murphy. So is it easy to do? You look at the ballot, and where do you go?
So nowadays, you're given that paper ballot that you fill in the little bubbles. I mean, ironic that the schools are turning to computerized testing, and now we're going back to filling bubbles to vote, and then it runs through a machine. In the lower left-hand side of the page, there will be a box that says write in, and you then bubble in the one under for governor, and you write in Pelto Murphy, Pelto, Jonathan Pelto, Ebony Murphy. What they tell me is that any write-in that mentions Pelto Murphy or Pelto will get counted as a vote. So it's relatively easy to do. You look for the bubble that says write in, and then you write in the name Pelto Murphy.
Great, Jonathan. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
And again, those websites where you can get more information are fairtest.org and unitedoptout.com. And to read Jonathan Pelto's blog, the website is jonathanpelto.com. This concludes this edition of The Assault on Public Education. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Do what happened to